Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story. This week on On Story, we'll hear from Seinfeld writer David Mandel. David Mandel was the executive producer and showrunner of the Emmy Award-winning TV show Veep, and was also an executive producer and director of Curb Your Enthusiasm. He was a writer for several seasons of Seinfeld, and also co-wrote the screenplay for the 2003 film adaptation of The Cat in the Hat. Comedian John Merriman spoke with Mandel at a retrospective screening of episodes of Seinfeld at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Seinfeld, courtesy of NBC.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that episode came to be? I've heard that it's quite a story.
All the really good episodes of the show, Seinfeld, and by the way, Curb as well, the really good ones kind of come from our lives. Back in the Seinfeld days, we would just ask you to submit ideas, like a list of Kramer, Elaine, just basically ideas. And you'd be going through this list, and they'd be terrible, just terrible ideas. And you get to the bottom one, and the bottom would be like, I don't know, George getting into a fight at a stereo store, if you can remember what those were. And there would, you just would go like, so this actually happened, right? And they would go, yeah, how did you know? And it was kind of because it was the only sort of funny, real one on the list. The first episode you saw tonight was written by Alec Berg. The second one was by me, although I will say the address on the labels that fall off is my parents' address, if you're interested in that kind of information. So in this episode, the George story of showing a woman who is not your dead fiancé as your dead fiancé to impress other women was something that my college roommate did when his girlfriend of like many years sort of broke up with him and broke his heart, and he was so sort of angry and whatever that he started using a picture of a different, better-looking girl.
I'm here to see a Mr. Art Vandelay.
I'm sorry, sir. There is no Mr. Vandelay here.
Well, let me just check and make sure I have the right name. Seems. Oh, I.
Oh, she is beautiful. Who is she?
Well, if you must know, she was my fiancée, Susan. May she rest in peace.
I'm so sorry. She was lovely. I'm Amanda.
I'm George.
The story is an extrapolation, but the original concept, that's 100% real. The sort of the notion of Kramer going to work at a business was a little bit of an extrapolation. I used to live in New York City, right near Tower Records on 66th and Broadway. And I was in that Tower Records so often, and often, you know, just sort of me, that, of course, normal people sort of assumed I worked there, kind of a thing. You know, I looked like someone that worked at Tower Records. And so, you know, you'd just be like, where's the world music section? And it got to the point where it's like, here, come on, let me just show you. Because it was just easier. And that turned into the Kramer story that you saw there. And then Manhans, which she's always very excited when I tell this story, is based on my now wife, who, in her defense, does not have man hands, but she grew up on a farm in Maine, and you know, like a working farm, like an honest to God farm. And so she has rough hands. She has hands that have actually done an honest day's labor, unlike these, which are the hands of a prince, raised to not lift anything that didn't need it to be lifted by his mother. And so she has these rough hands, and she used to call them farm hands or farmy. And I didn't think, and I sort of took that, and that became man hands.
She had man hands.
Man hands?
The hands of a man. It's like a creature out of Greek mythology. I mean, she was like part woman, part horrible beast.
Would you prefer it if she had no hands at all?
Would she have hooks?
Do hooks make it more attractive, Jerry?
Kind of cool looking.
Okay. Listen, you're picking me up in White Plains tomorrow, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I got 5 huge boxes of buttons.
Right. Well, if you need an extra set of hands, I know you can call.
Jerry!
You know, it's not her favorite thing of my work. Although I think we were split up at the time, and it sort of got us back together. So that's got to count for something. But anyway, that's the origins, if you will.
That's terrific.
And now you know where my parents live also.
Yeah. So. I read that story in your New York Times wedding announcement.
Yes, where she was so happy that it was included there as well. Yes, that's every bride's dream. Be in the New York Times and have them tell the story about your man hands. But anyway.
You came to Seinfeld in the later seasons. You were a fan first.
Yeah, I was, I guess the story of my career is sort of joining shows once they're really giant hits. But no, I was there for the final three seasons. So Larry's last season and then the two seasons without Larry, basically. So it was already, it achieved popularity. And for me, as sort of somebody interested in comedy, I was working at SNL, and I was just a huge fan. And then my two good friends, and then later on writing partners, Jeff Schaefer and Alec Berg, who wrote The Label Maker, they got a job there during my last year of Seinfeld. Of Saturday Night Live. And so they were working there, I was watching, and then I started sort of visiting them at the office a lot. And I would kind of just go and hang out. And I guess a little bit like Kramer, they eventually gave me a job. So these things do work. Better than, I guess, maybe Tower Records. But anyway.
Was that daunting to come into a show that you were a fan of? And quite a writer's room, I would imagine.
I mean, I think one of the things about Seinfeld that people don't necessarily know is at the time it was run incredibly differently than, I guess, modern sort of sitcoms. Larry had never worked on a sitcom. Jerry had acted, I guess, briefly on Benson, but certainly was not in the writer's room. So they didn't do that sort of let's put everybody in a room and have sort of this gang write thing that happens on so many sitcoms. Larry and Jerry ran the show very much, I guess, closer to a drama, if anybody here has any experience with that, in the sense of we were responsible for sort of pitching our own stories for an episode. So I would say, you know, on this episode, I don't remember the order it went, but Jerry dates man hands. Great, that's your Jerry story. And then Kramer gets a job. Great, that's your Kramer. You know, you would get all four approved, and then you would start outlining your episode. Now again, they're approving it, and then at some point you would write it, and then sometimes it went to table, and sometimes they took it from you and just felt like they needed to bring it on home. That was sort of the system, which again, not a writer's room, and that's sort of how I like to work to this day. I mean, basically, how I do what I do, whether it's Veep or whatever, is very much like I'm of the coaching tree of Larry David, basically.
You touched on this earlier, but Seinfeld has influenced so many shows since it began. It's hard to even imagine that there was a time when it wasn't a hit when it first started.
It wasn't, and obviously it's just, changed everything. It's kind of wild when you think back about it.
It's incredible. Can you talk just a little bit about sort of the state of comedy before Seinfeld?
Look, it continued after Seinfeld, but Seinfeld obviously had its effects. You know, the majority of shows were, I don't know, husbands and wives in a house. And, you know, for act one of the sitcom, they argued about taking out the garbage. And then the act break was, you're still not taking out the garbage? And then they'd argue about it for 15 more minutes. At the end of the show, the husband would apologize, say, I love you, and take the garbage out. And you know, it worked a little bit for the honeymooners, but it definitely started to feel like a bit of a tired formula. And I think sort of Seinfeld almost like, and I know the joke has always been, oh, it's the show about nothing, but obviously these shows are jam-packed with just thick interlocking plots. And so it wasn't so much about nothing, but it wasn't about what people thought sitcoms were about. And the other thing too was, while it was a multicam sitcom with a live audience that you were hearing there, it feels when you watch it, I mean, I know it's a little dated looking with the film stock and whatnot, but it has the feel of really what we came to think about as sort of single cams, even though it's a multicam. And when you think about that too, along with the what it was about, the various plots sort of bumping in and out of each other and occasionally colliding at the end, when you think about that sort of multicam but feeling like a single cam, for lack of a better word, the New York City, the sort of what seemed at the time like a niche idea, which was it was legitimately about New York City and living in New York City, as opposed to, I guess, like, yes, they live in New York, but it's a, you know, a messy person and a clean person living together. By the way, I love The Odd Couple, but you know what I'm saying? It was a set as opposed to it felt like New York. It's just all of television that really does follow it really owes a debt. I mean, I think there's no show that you see that isn't what it is a little bit because Seinfeld came before it and kind of opened the doors to what comedy I think could be. And again, I say that's, you know, that's Larry, that's Jerry, that ain't me. I mean, I was there, but yeah.
Right. It's hard to even remember a time before it in a way.
There's an interesting thing on YouTube, if you're ever interested. I don't know how the hell you find it, and someone maybe can find it better than me, but they took episodes of sitcoms and they took the jokes out. They took like an episode of Seinfeld, I think an episode of Friends, and I think an episode of The Big Bang Theory. And when you take the jokes out of The Big Bang Theory, I think it's like 2 minutes long. There's very little like information. And Friends was like, I think it was like 7 or 8 minutes. It was respectable or something like that. Seinfeld, when you take the jokes out, is still like, you know, 11, 12 minutes because there's a lot of plot and a lot of the jokes are sort of baked into the structure more than, obviously we have jokes, obviously, but so much of it is sort of like, you know, these things kind of coming back and things bumping into each other just structurally. And again, I think it speaks to sort of the uniqueness of Seinfeld and how much things after Seinfeld became Seinfeldian, even though obviously they came up with their own rhythms, I think.
Every show feels like it's this incredible puzzle with all these pieces, and, you know, beats that come back and grab you.
I mean, that was the fun part. And, you know, then we sort of do it or did it differently, similar but differently on Curb, where obviously we didn't write scripts, but, you know, the same gist of working out these stories and outlining them so the same thing happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And Bizarro Jerry in particular is such a fun episode because it relies on the audience being so familiar with these characters already.
Yeah, I mean,
able to play off it.
It was very much the show of someone who had been watching the show.
Where were you?
Here, I guess, and I went out and picked up a paper.
I had to ask Kevin to leave his office and come and pick me up.
Well, what are friends for?
Yes, and he is a friend, Jerry. He's reliable. He's considerate. He's like your exact opposite.
So he's Bizarro Jerry.
Bizarro Jerry?
Yeah, like Bizarro Superman. Superman's exact opposite, who lives in the backwards Bizarro world. Up is down, down is up. He says hello when he leaves, goodbye when he arrives.
Shouldn't he say bad bye? Isn't that the opposite of goodbye?
No, it's still goodbye.
There's definitely, and I think rightly or wrongly, and you don't have to like it, I think that's very much the change that came over Seinfeld. Not just the seasons where Larry was gone, but even the later seasons where Larry was there, as they opened it up to a writer's room and started hiring people, I guess for lack of a better word, that were fans of the show, you started to see the show got a little more, I guess, meta, for lack of a better word, with episodes like the Kenny Rogers Chicken Roasters. And again, not always whole episodes, but pieces of episodes. And this one certainly, you know, with its commentary on who the characters are, these sort of doppelgangers and whatnot, there was a lot of commentary, but also commentary on sitcoms at the time. You have a lot of that same husband and wife angrily yelling at each other, sort of playing with those sitcom tropes. You have also, you know, like sort of like the word friends at a time when Friends had actually come along as a show, which was sort of interesting if you think about it. Anyway, just, you know, some of the stuff I find very interesting.
Can you tell me a little bit about kind of writing from your reality and sort of, you mentioned at the beginning you found writers.
Before I got the job at Seinfeld, knowing that I was going to basically be applying for a job at Seinfeld, I was starting to just write them down and gather stuff from my life, gather stuff from friends who were not comedy writers, you know, just stealing wholesale. And, you know, even from my first episode, which was the pool guy, that was in my first season. This is from my second season. But my first episode, the pool guy, the whole notion of sort of the social class difference between Jerry and a guy that works in his health club was a friend of mine who was in a health club where another guy who went to our high school worked in the health club.
Who is Ramel?
He's the pool guy.
What pool guy?
Do me a favor, just stick around while he's here.
Yeah, no problem.
Hey, Jerry, how are you, crazy guy? So, Ramon, this is my friend Elaine.
Yeah, and I was just leaving. Goodbye, Jerry.
So, what are you doing around here, Ramon?
Well, I was in the neighborhood. I figured I'd check you out.
Actually, I kind of had some things to do.
Oh, yeah? Where are you going?
Just, you know, I don't know, stuff I gotta do.
Hey, that's cool. I'm up for some stuff.
All right.
Kramer becoming the 777 film movie phone guy was something that had happened, believe it or not, to other friends of mine. Again, the germs of the ideas, I'm not lifting seven beats of a story. It was more like, God, we get a lot of wrong numbers. People keep thinking our phone number is 777 film. Oh, what if Kramer, that was Kramer. And then, oh my God, what if he started, you know, actually answering the calls, you know what I mean, and trying to help people.
Hello, and welcome to Movie Phone, brought to you by the New York Times and Hot 97. Coming to theaters this Friday, Kevin Bacon, Susan Sarandon. You've got to get me over that mouth! Now! There's no higher place than Mountain High. Rated R. If you know the name of the movie you'd like to see, press 1.
Kramer? That you?
Elaine?
What time does Chow Fun start?
I don't know.
That's sort of what Seinfeld really did, and I think this was Larry's real genius. It's a little bit, if anybody has an improv sort of background, if anybody does like UCB or any of that kind of stuff, it's sort of that yes and in a way. And what I mean by that is, because so much of all the plot in Seinfeld was very compacted and pushed down and jammed full, you would get to places where other sitcoms would end very quickly. You know what I mean? Like maybe if somebody, not that somebody's gonna do the 777 film, but if there was a show about a guy with a wrong, you know, getting a lot of wrong numbers, there's no version of a show where then they start helping the wrong numbers, and then that's Kramer, that's Seinfeld. And so in that world where that happens, you get to this place that then, of course, allows you to have Kramer give the wrong numbers to two different people, you know, the wrong time so that they can collide together. But it is that thing of like, you're getting all this other story. I don't know what to call it. It's almost like beats at the time that seemed very outside the box. They get rid of a lot of the nonsense and they get to it. There was definitely always like, explaining this and explaining that and explaining this, you know, always a lot of explanation. And even, look, the Bizarro Jerry has explanation because people do have to go, what's Bizarro Jerry or whatever, or why are you saying man hands? But I remember in the early episode, my first episode in The Pool Guy, Jerry or Elaine tells George about why Susan getting involved in his life is a bad idea or something. And then Kramer comes in and already knows the theory and kind of goes, oh, you gotta keep your worlds apart. And it was like, you know about the worlds? Yeah, I know about the worlds.
Well, have you spoken to Elaine yet today?
No, why?
She called Susan last night.
Oh, yeah, I know.
How do you know?
That was my idea.
Your idea?
Yeah.
What'd you do that for?
She was looking for someone to go to the show with.
Well, that was really a stupid thing. You know what's gonna happen now?
Worlds collide.
What? Yeah!
Because this world is your sanctuary, and if that world comes in contact
blows up! So if you know that, what did you tell Elaine for?
I didn't know. Kramer told me about the worlds.
You couldn't figure out the world's theory for yourself? It's just common sense. Anybody knows you gotta keep your worlds apart!
Yeah, I guess I slipped up.
My inclination, as my writing my first Seinfeld, was every
thing had to be explained to everyone. And when some of these things, you imagine a world, you presuppose a world where these guys who are sitting in a coffee shop, you know, 23 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week, they already talked about this as a theory 6 years ago. And so when you sort of start to think like that, the show gets very interesting. And I always liken a little bit to like the way the original Star Wars starts. It's like, it is a time of great rebellion. And then all of a sudden there's people attacking people. And you sort of have to catch up. I think those are the good guys. Those are the bad guys. And I think Seinfeld had a willingness to sort of do that, of just going, you know, it's this. Oh, yeah, it is. As opposed to having to explain every little thing. I have a great regret of an episode that we never did, I will tell you. We just ran out of time that final season. I, as you can see from this episode, and then also if you ever saw the backwards episode that I did with Peter Melman, I love format breaking. I love it. And it was something, again, based on little bits and pieces of things that happened to me. The basic idea would have been that the gang would have gone on vacation. I guess I was thinking Mexico. And the gist of it would have been they would have checked into a hotel, you know, at a resort, and Jerry's hotel room would have been the main set, and it would have been right across the hallway from Kramer's hotel room. And then there would have been this, like, Mexican, like, restaurant that would have been the coffee shop. And basically, it would have been an episode of Seinfeld with Mexican sets on vacation. And it is my great regret.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. Support for On Story comes from Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers and third-generation winemakers, creating sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of the Bogle family values since 1968. This show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox and Colin Heyer. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.